is Our American Stories, and all month we're bringing you stories for National Foster Care Moment. And that's the good and the bad, the tragic and the uplifting, and often in the same story. Today we're going to spend the whole hour on extraordinary Americans serving the most forgotten among forgotten kids in foster care. And that's what we love to do here on Our American Stories, tell you the story and reveal the story of the true nature and character of this country. Its past, its present, its future, through the arts, through faith, through history, through literature, you name it. And sports, of course, because you can't tell the American story without it. And the program we're talking about today is called Wendy's Wonderful Kids, a partnership between the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption, Wendy's Restaurants, Wendy's customers, and donors to sponsor specialized recruiters whose mission is to find families for kids in foster care that many deem unadoptable. And my goodness, be still my heart. Let's first hear highlights from our conversation earlier today with the foundation's president, Rita Saarinen. And then we'll talk with one of their marvelous recruiters, Sandy Certain, and then a father who worked with Sandy to adopt from foster care, and that's Tim Hess. The name Dave Thomas is familiar to many of us as the founder of Wendy's. But here's Rita telling us a little more about the man behind the third largest burger chain in this country.
His story is what drove the creation of the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption. He was adopted as an infant. His adoptive mother passed away when he was five. His father was a bit of a moving worker, so he was constantly on the road looking for another job, so they moved a lot. And Dave would have told you that his fondest memories during that time were when he spent time with his grandma Minnie. And in fact, when they lived in Indiana and had been a series of moves to get to Indiana, Dave was 16 and his father was going to move again. And he said, no, I'm going to stay in Indiana. And so at 16, he was on his own. He lived at the YWCA. He experienced what so many of our children in foster care experience, even though he had an adoptive family, right? He had his dad, he had his grandma Minnie, but that unknown of moving from place to place, of wondering, what I'm kind of on my own here. Our kids who age out of foster care at 18 feel that same thing. I'm on my own. The one thing that drove Dave is he and his dad, when they did have time together, they inevitably were going out to dinner and they ate at restaurants and he loved hamburgers. And literally at like age 12, Dave Thomas said, I'm going to create the best hamburger restaurant ever. And that's not just legend. That's exactly what he said. So,
and that's remarkable. And by the way, we hear this story over and over again. Sometimes I think the scars of childhood fuel so many of the great success stories in this country. And then so many of these same people, well, they go and they pave backwards. They go and they look back and they give and they give and they give and they give. And these stories have to be told more frequently in this country to remind people of who we really are. Between 1989 and 2002, Dave Thomas appeared in over 800 different TV commercials, sharing his love of fresh burgers and cold Frosties. But like so many great Americans, Dave wasn't satisfied simply becoming rich and famous. No, Dave wanted more. Dave wanted to give back.
The first President Bush asked him to step up and really work on behalf of this sort of Adoption Works campaign, and really the rest is history. He created the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption in 1992. To do two things, to elevate the conversation about children in North America's foster care systems who've been freed for adoption. They're simply waiting for an adoptive family to step forward. So raise awareness about these children, help dispel the myths and misperceptions that surround them. They're not too old, they're not too damaged, they're not too dangerous, they're just kids waiting for a family. And then he very wisely made us a nonprofit public charity, so we're a grant-making organization. And it allowed us to reach out and really look at and create best practices, great policy, great practice on behalf of some children who frankly get lost in a very complex intermingling of systems, child welfare system, juvenile justice system, education system. All of those systems circle around children.
And so many of those systems have lots of bureaucracies. And this is where the private sector and private charity can step in like a laser and get the job done, and with the efficiency of the private sector. And the good thing about Dave and all the work he's done and all the people that are doing it is there are over 100,000 children in foster care today, ready and waiting to be adopted. And while all need loving families, some are effectively neglected, again, by our large publicly funded social safety net.
No one was focusing on this very defined target population of children, older children. And by older, we mean age 9 or older. You may not think of that. You think of a 9-year-old as just a kid, right? But research shows that pretty much by the time a child turns 9 in foster care and they've been freed for adoption, the likelihood of them actually being adopted decreases significantly. And there were too many social workers or people really charged with getting them an adoptive home who would say, well, this child's just not adoptable. They've been in the system too long, or they're too old, or they're in a sibling group. And the reality is what happens is a child makes a journey through foster care. Our first goal is to get that child home if we can and safe. But if the circumstances are so profoundly unsafe that this family can't be made whole, then the court goes through a series of processes and legally frees that child for adoption. The day that child's freed, the job of the system is to find them a family. But so many of these children turn 18 in foster care and then leave the system. We failed them. We haven't found them a family. And that's what we call aging out. They age out of the system at age 18, in some states 21. And here's the problem with that. Anyone that knows an 18 knows that this is a very complex society for someone to be on their own at age 18 when they've grown up in a system environment.
I mean, imagine that. It's devastating, actually, when you really think about it. And the numbers are devastating. 1 in 5 who age out are homeless. 1 in 2 unemployed. Fewer than 3% earn college degrees. And 1 in 4 have post-traumatic stress disorder. And why the heck not? Moved around alone like this? I know what had happened to me. Anybody I know. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Wendy's. Foster care, adoption, all of the above. When we come back, we'll talk to some folks who've been doing something about it. I can't wait for you to meet them. I can't wait to meet them myself. More after these messages.
Yo, it's time for a coffee break.
Not quite. Let's do this, homies.
When I need a tasty treat to pick me up, that lifts me off my feet.
I'll go C to the T to the T to the F.
All I want to do is just chill with you. But you know what else might be cool? Maybe I can get frosty with you. Our temperature's getting high. I think the party's on fire. Cause we're so hot. Twisted frosty, ooh baby, do you wanna get frosty with me? Count the top, baby.
This is Our American Stories, and we've been talking about Wendy's Wonderful Kids Adoption. And of course, we love food here on Our American Stories, and we were just talking over the break about the Frosty. One of the best things that's happened in my life the past year is I have moved from one side of town to the other, and within 1 minute, within striking distance, within walking distance, the Frosty, which, as Jesse opined, because we believe it's not a milkshake, no, and it's not ice cream. It's its own food group. And what did you call this,
Jesse? It's kind of like the Guinness of shakes. It's not really a shake. It's not really ice cream. It's in its own little category.
It's own thing. Yeah. It's its own thing. And we know about the great food. We know about the great business success of Wendy's. But as is so often the case in this great country, that business success and the people behind it want to give back. And they give back in a big way. And so we were leaving off with some really grim statistics about what happens, for instance, when people age out of foster care. And my goodness, it's really tragic, actually. And a couple of people working to do something about that. Sandy Certain is a top Wendy's Wonderful Kids recruiter working for Sierra Forever Families in California. And she's here along with Tim Hess, who adopted a young boy, now an amazing young man, that others gave up on. Sandy, Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
time.
Absolutely.
You bet.
We're having.
You bet. And sorry to go on and on about the Frosty, but, you know, some things are really important, and that's one of them for us. So you're the folks who do what everybody else says is too hard. Sandy, we'll start with you this segment. We just have to start by learning a bit about you first, because we always do that here. Tell us where you're from and what led you to this kind of work.
You know, it was sort of a circuitous route. I never went out thinking this is what I'm going to do when I'm growing up. I grew up in Los Angeles. I went into the military, kind of followed military path until civil service, launching missiles from Titan missiles, and then moved to Sacramento and changed everything when I adopted a special needs daughter from the foster care system.
And that did it. That literally changed the course of your life.
Well, yeah, because it seemed like a really good idea at the time. I had three birth sons, and I had my second son has an autistic spectrum disorder, so I thought, piece of cake, I can handle this. It's totally different. Every kid is different, but this changed up everything and kind of opened a new path of things that can be done and things that should be done.
Yep. And you spent some time, you obviously had an education in this space. You were at least a Bachelor of Science in Psychology. You had a Master's of Science in Marriage, Family, and the Child. So this the area itself, and that is human psychology and development, was important to you. But then this life event triggered this specific passion. You worked in the field of social work, and you still do. And my dad was a superintendent of schools, and he always felt bad for so many of the government social workers because their caseloads were just gigantic, just like the high school guidance counselor, just almost an insurmountable caseload. You work differently. There are small cases, I think, is one distinctive, small caseloads, and then you work from the kid out. Talk about the distinctive nature of how you do what you do and you approach how you approach the work.
I think the Dave Thomas Foundation itself just really worked within the sort of parameters of what I learned from doing special needs advocacy and parent partner work. And then at the same time, I was getting my bachelor's degree and master's degree in raising kids and doing this work. And I think all of it is this ongoing learning experience. And the fact that we're not looking for a kid to put in the family. We're trying to help a family, a child, find the right family. So they really give us the opportunity to have a much smaller caseload. I think mine is supposed to be 20, and we'll stick with that. It could be more. It probably is more. But we really get this opportunity to get to know the child. And I think as we talk about Tim and Marlon, that was the key to helping Marlon trust enough to move forward, was the fact that I was able to develop this trusting relationship and sort of start healing some of the sort of misperceptions that get so deeply ingrained over the life in foster care and whatever trauma brought them in, plus that experience of bouncing from one home to another and people never really loving you and never really belong. So I think Marlon was 13, 12 or 13. He had pretty much decided nobody's going to do anything but me. So having that relationship, I think, is the best way to kind of do it. And then being really selective in families. You know, a lot of times people will express interest in a child, but they just don't have the skill set or personality type or lifestyle that would be the right match for that child. So hopefully we want to do it so when it's all said and done, it's lasting and perfect, like Marlon's story.
Yeah, a lot of this sounds like matchmaking, and then there's a deep, deep desire to get to know the individual. And as I indicated before, my dad spent a life in education, and he was always reaching for the, quote, kids who couldn't be educated, because he was one of those kids until he was diagnosed with chronic stuttering. And they had actually taken him into the really super slow learner section, and he ended up getting a PhD. And so for him, finding that God-given talent of a kid, no matter where they stood on the aisle, particularly special needs kids, was important. How do kids end up being labeled unadoptable? How does that happen?
In general, I mean, all the kids, the children that I get referrals for, they're all identified as having one or more barriers to adoption. And Lucy defined that children with developmental disabilities or medical needs or large sibling groups, teenagers, but almost all of them come in with still trauma-reactive behaviors. I mean, they have tantrums. They do stuff sometimes because they're trying to get over what was done to them. But it's not a lifelong condition. I mean, I think what we see most and what we look forward and strive to achieve is that children heal in the context of a safe and loving home, a place where no matter what you do, you're loved. You know, I think any of us can think of a time we would have liked to ship our bio kids out for a couple of weeks here and there. That would be when you don't give them away, that makes all the difference.
Indeed. And when we come back over on the other side of the break, Tim, we're going to get to you and your story. And then the next segment, we'll talk about what our audience can do and learn, and what, you know, what people just listening can do in their area, in their neighborhood, this country, this state. This show is being heard all over the country. So one last question. In terms of having worked in the public and the private sector, what are the differences you find, and what can the public sector learn from the private sector as you work in conjunction with and alongside the Dave Thomas Group?
I think in general, more and more people are reaching out to foster care adoption. And as each family finds it successful and they spread the word and they tell other people or they come back and do it again. I just finalized a sibling set of four with a family that had adopted a 13-year-old teen and finalized last year. So I think it's word of mouth. It's seeing the success. It's just getting rid of all of the stereotypes and realizing that these are all viable human beings that have so much to offer the world. I think I'm just excited for you to hear Marlon's story, because he literally was that kid that was, they thought needed special ed and wouldn't do anything. And he's a whole different boy from when he became Marlon Hess.
Yep, and we look forward to hearing that. And this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And for the hour, we're talking about Wendy's Wonderful Kids Adoption. And right now, we're talking with Sandy Certain. And we'll be talking with Tim Hess, who adopted a young boy, now a young man that others had given up on and society had given up on. But again, as we just learned and heard from Sandy, you know, what kids can become in a loving home with unconditional love? Well, we can't imagine, if we have unconditional love, we can't imagine life without it. And my goodness, the imagination of these people, the beautiful nature of their work, we're here to highlight that here on Our American Stories. More after these messages, these great stories. This is Our American Stories, and we're talking with Sandy Certain, who is a top Wendy's Wonderful Kids recruiter working for Sierra Forever Families in California, and she's joining us along with Tim Hess, who adopted a young boy, now an amazing young man. And Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks.
Tim, tell us how your adopted son came into your life. How did this all happen?
As our two daughters started leaving the house to college and adulthood, we had a room available in our home, and it just God kind of put it on my heart that, you know, one of the things that I can do is, you know, love on kids. That's kind of been my my life's journey through teaching and coaching. And so we pursued the thought of foster parenting, and so that's what initiated the steps towards getting certified and becoming a foster parent. And in the middle of that process, somebody mentioned foster adoption, and so we said, yeah, let's go ahead and do that. And so when we got through all the certification and training process, we sat in the adoption agency's office and looked at basically a catalog with pictures and bios, and that day we saw Marlon and read his bio and his statement that he just wants a family to love him. And so that immediately just connected with us, and my wife and I were absolutely on the same page with that. And so we made some phone calls, and that's when we got introduced with Sandy Marlon.
And Sandy, tell us about Tim's son Marlon. What was his life story up until you came in contact with him? And then, Tim, we're going to come back to you, because my goodness, you make the choice, now this new life begins. But Sandy, talk to us about Marlon.
So Marlon was an amazing big brother. He had a little sister, I think she was probably about 4 or 5 years younger than him. And he, I think, just made himself the promise that he was not going to leave her. And if we couldn't find a placement together, he had already decided he's just going to grow up and take care of her. And she had some pretty significant special needs. She had a form of albinism that makes her legally blind, and some mild delays, and it was just hard. And Marlon was going to take care of her, and I think he had also had that experience where, you know what, I can't trust anybody. So we had found, you know, you hate to separate kids, but I think the Department of Child and Protective Services had decided these kids stood a better chance separated, and there was a family near where the Hesses lived that was visiting with his sister. So right at Christmas time, it was funny, I think everybody was out but me and the Hesses, and they called and said they were interested in him. And what I always try and do with my kids is avoid that matchmaking, arranged marriage kind of thing.
Yep.
And just said, Marlon, let's just meet these folks and hang out. And we went to, they had this big inner tube slide thing set up that defied gravity and was crazy. And the Hesses were down and Marlon was down, and I sat and drank me some coffee on the ground. But they just connected. Being athletic and sports, he excelled at. And that was really kind of a core tenet of this family. Every member of the family is active athletically. So he just took his time getting to know them. And I think another really special thing about this family is he wanted to graduate with his eighth grade class. So they met him in December, but continued just visiting him and having him over. And it's a couple hours drive from where they live to Sacramento, where Marlon was. But they just continue building a relationship. And that's when it's the best, is when all parties kind of fall in love and decide to become a family.
Yep. And without pressure, without preconceptions, it sounds like, which is just beautiful. Tim, but you're a coach. By the way, my dad was a coach, so it always felt like we had 12 adoptive kids in the family. He was a basketball coach, and that was the roster. So there were always these 12 sweaty, smelly guys around my house from the time I could remember. So in a sense, you have this capacity, but yet this is different than coaching kids and raising your own kids. What were you worried about? Were you nervous at all, Tim, you and your wife?
Wow. Not nervous, extremely peaceful throughout the whole process. We just knew it was the right it was the right thing to do. And so, that's the way I can describe it. And we were, as a family, totally on the same page and very peaceful throughout the whole process, and always were 100% certain that we were doing the right thing.
That's great, and I think that's when things work the best, is when you are at peace, and it's good to hear. I was hoping that for the folks who are out there listening who are nervous, it might mean you're not quite ready. It might not. It might. I think everyone's different. I have any number of friends who've adopted and also and worked with the foster care system, and everyone's different.
There was a time when it wasn't right, you know, between my wife and I, in terms of going forth, you know, where I would suggest and she wasn't ready. She wasn't at the right point in her life. And then when we were on the same page, then bam, it was full steam ahead. So yeah, there is a time that is right. And that's when we went full steam ahead.
And that's so good. And you got to know that time, and timing is so much a part of all of life. So Tim, we've heard about the sister, and that's so important. And we heard also from Sandy during the break that that you really understood the prior relationships in Marlon's life and really respected them. Talk about how you bridged that divide and made him comfortable with all the older people in his life that he cared about.
Yeah, we just felt like we needed to help Marlon maintain relationship with his family. And so we're constantly encouraging him to communicate with them and, you know, and just keeping that door open as much as possible. He's just yesterday, as a matter of fact, we got a sad message that about one of his family members that had passed away rather suddenly. And so that was quite a traumatic experience for him, and we cried through that yesterday. It was a tough little stretch there, and so you know, he and I are just going through that life process together, and we're trying to find out information about when and where services, so he can be there for that part of his family, and you know, try to comfort them during their time of need.
Well, being there with a boy when he needs you and loving him unconditionally, it's a beautiful thing. When we come back, we're going to discuss a few other things about this remarkable life, young Marlon, where we think he's headed, where the family's headed, maybe more. But certainly we want other people to hear about this story, because there are so many of them played out all around this country. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Sandy Certain, a top Wendy's Wonderful Kids recruiter working for Sierra Forever Families in California, and Tim Hess, a man and his wife who stepped up to the plate and just loved a child unconditionally. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and here on this show, we tell every kind of story. This week, we did an hour on Bob Dylan, an hour on Barbra Streisand, the remarkable lives they led, the impact they had on this country through their work, and particularly, their childhoods were fascinating, and they came from such different places and such different kinds of homes, one in almost the backwoods of Minnesota, and the other Brooklyn, New York. One a loving family, but one that never traveled, and Dylan wanted out. Barbra Streisand, the family told her she'd never amount to anything. A cruel father, and my goodness, a cruel stepfather, and a mother who basically said, be a secretary, that's all that's in you. And Streisand proved her parents wrong. But my goodness, the scars that that young lady had, and that probably in some respects still has. You can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and listen to those great American stories, and you'll hear a lot of great music, too. And all this month, again, we've been doing stories for National Foster Care Month. We also do a month on adoption as well. And a couple of us here are Christians, secular people, Christians alike, do remarkable work in this space. We really do try and drive real life issues. And for us, the biggest life issue is adoption and foster care. There are lives that need love. And my goodness, we're hearing about, well, just this one case, and there are so many more. Sandy Certain is a top Wendy's Wonderful Kids recruiter working for Sierra Forever Families in California. And she's here along with Tim Hess, who adopted a young boy, Marlon, who is now an amazing young man, a man that others had given up on. And again, thank you both so much for all the work you do and for, you know, just taking the time to join us here right on the cusp of Memorial Day weekend.
Again, I appreciate being here.
You bet. You know, Tim, tell us a fond memory or two, something that might have surprised you about Marlon, something that Marlon might have been surprised about you, because, you know, when you start to get to know each other, it's those intimacies, it's those small moments and time shared that really can surprise you.
One of the very first times we all got together as a family with our two daughters, my wife and I, and Marlon, we were eating at a restaurant, and I have a tendency of eating what everyone else in the family doesn't eat. And so Marlon was what appeared to me as being finished with his meal. And so, as I would with my daughters or wife, I reached over and kind of grabbed the rest of his hamburger and stuffed it in my mouth, and he looked at me like I was crazy. And then I kind of realized, oh, my goodness, I kind of stepped over the bounds a little bit. Yeah, I still fondly remember that. One of the first times we were together was at a wrestling tournament, actually. And he was in a very big venue, and he, you know, didn't know anything about wrestling, really, and he was able to hang out with our team and connect with those guys. But throughout our early conversations, he was like, no, I'm a basketball player. Almost everybody that met him would ask him, hey, you going to wrestle? Nope, I'm playing basketball. And so that was totally fine with me.
Yep.
We do not push our kids one way or the other. And so I was resigned to that fact. And he walked into our sign-ups that I had at school and for wrestling. So when he was a freshman, he walked into the wrestling or into the wrestling sign-ups, and there he was. And I was like, wow. And, you know, my eyes widened, and I was undeniably excited about the prospect of coaching my son in the sport that I appreciate so much. So that was pretty neat.
That's great. And by the way, a couple of years ago, I had the luck to, and I interview all kinds of people in my life, both sides of the political aisle. I try to stay away from that and get at the life stories. And Secretary Rumsfeld had talked about his wrestling as a young man had prepared him for everything in life. He had been a champion wrestler, and he just talked about he was trying to almost push people into wrestling or Boy Scouts, especially young men. It's such a great outlet for their anxieties, but at the same time teaches tremendous discipline and so many other things. I'm not telling you anything you don't know about the sport you love. How is Marlon doing now? Tell us about where he is, what he's doing.
Well, I'll go back a little bit because, you know, he came into our family, and then he comes into the school where I'm also a teacher and a coach, and he enters two sports that I'm involved with, football and wrestling at the time. And, you know, he starts out as a freshman. He's in the wrestling room. He's one of our best freshmen, and, you know, it was quite surprising. And, again, a great blessing to be able to work with them so closely in different capacities. As a teacher, he was actually in one of my classes as a freshman, and then as a coach, and then as a father, and that was amazing. But to see his progression, you know, as gaining confidence and abilities, and skills during those years of high school was amazing. Culminating as a senior, he actually won our Athlete of the Year award, which was just amazing.
I mean, yep.
A school of 2000 to be considered the best athlete of the in the school was amazing, you know. And academically, having some definite struggles. I mean, that was a always something that, and it continues to be a struggle for him. Learning in the traditional manner is a challenge for him, and it continues to be. But he has he's overcome a lot of those challenges, and he has adapted. He learns just in a way that's different than traditional methods. So, you know, he went into our local junior college and competed with them, the wrestling team, for 2 years. And at this current juncture, he's working full-time right now and kind of trying to sort out what his next step will be. One of his gifts is working with special needs kids. He did that through high school as a teacher's aide in the special needs class, and did that for several years. And the kids loved him, the teachers loved him, and he's looking to pursue that as a career, working with autistic young people.
Well, that's fantastic. So, that's fantastic news. And Sandy, you know, not all of these stories work out so well. We're going to play you a quick clip, and then we're going to get your reaction to it to close out this hour. Here's a story that Rita Sorenen told us earlier today. And again, she's the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption president.
We knew of one young man last year who wove in and out of care. His story became public when he was diagnosed with an incurable cancer, and he was still in foster care at that point. His caseworkers got him in and out of the appropriate health care activities. His cancer went into remission. He aged out of care. He wasn't adopted, but he was finding his way. He was absolutely finding his way. In fact, he was enrolled in college. He wanted to go on and become a journalist, and he wanted to write about this story, his story, and other kids' stories. And then that cancer flared up again, and he was in the hospital. And here's who visited him in the hospital: his former caseworker and someone else from the agency that had known about him, and some of his fellow foster care alumni visited him. And at one point, he looked up at his caseworker, and it was nearing the end. He simply wasn't going to make it through this time. And he looked up at his caseworker, and he said, "Who is going to bury me?"
Oh, my goodness. And so, Sandy, what would you say to people who are listening now who might want to do what you do, and that is, you know, work in this space? It's daunting, no doubt, because there are great stories and there are tragic stories. Just about a minute to talk to the folks who are listening.
I think it's all about this paradigm shift. It's the Dave Thomas Foundation and Wendy's Wonderful Kids that all children are adoptable. And for people in both the Department of Social Services that oversee these foster youth, as well as all the other agencies, is just getting out there and not letting them age out. I mean, we had a period of time where a single worker could say, "Oh, nobody's going to want that kid." And over this 8 years that I've done this, and I have well over 50 finalizations of the hardest kids, there is somebody for everybody. And we just have to try, and we have to believe it can be done. You know, I think it's that believing. It's our belief, and it's each individual family's belief that these kids are amazing and deserving of a loving life. I mean, when I thought of Tim talking about Marlon's achievements, before, when he was just visiting the house, they had a wall of awards for both daughters, and they had a space cleared, and they said, "Those are for you. Whatever you choose to do, those are for you. We know you will succeed." So I think it really is, it's believing and getting out there and getting it done in a way that's respectful and honors the kids and understands that they are starting from a different point in life, but it doesn't mean they can't end up in a safe and happy place.
Well, it's a beautiful way to close things out. And Tim, thank you for all you've done, and we'd love to have Marlon on sometime. and continue this dialogue. And it's been a great week and a great month talking about foster care. And again, we've been talking to Sandy Certain, a top Wendy's Wonderful Kids recruiter working for Sierra Forever Families in California, and Tim Hess, who adopted a young boy, now a young man, Marlon. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Go to ouramericannetwork.org to capture all of our work and storytelling. This is Our American Stories, and all month long, we've been doing commencement speeches, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And boy, we did some great ones the other day. Denzel Washington's was terrific. My favorite, along with General Peter Pace's. But we had to talk about the bad ones, and this is backed by popular demand, with actually a few more cuts, because this was the worst one. Duke graduates were bored to death over the 2015 commencement speech by physician and anthropologist Dr. Paul Farmer. In this 38-minute speech, man, that's just long, before the entire student body and faculty, Farmer rambles on and on while occasionally stopping to criticize the audience for not laughing. While we won't torture you with the entire speech, you might prefer to be waterboarded rather than hearing what you're about to, well, hear right now. Dr. Farmer started out with a, quote, a joke about how he thought he was in trouble when the president of Duke University, Richard Broadhead, called him to ask him if he would give a commencement speech.
Broadhead's subtext seemed to be, after all Duke has done for you, what have you done for Duke? That was supposed to be funny. You know,
oof.
How come it starts raining when I get up?
Because you suck.
Ouch, Jesse.
I'm sure he's a nice
back.
Guy.
I'm sure he's wonderful. You can hear him already. You know he's a jerk. Dr. Farmer goes on to joke about how he missed the call from the university president and had to actually call him back.
Conspiracy theories picked up speed along with my pulse. When my prompt response, I called Broadhead like 2 seconds later, led to more anxiety. His assistant, who I knew well, refused to tell me a thing. Oh, I'm not at all sure what this is about, she said darkly, suggesting I call him at home that night. It had to be that I was the worst trustee in Duke's history, reaching back into the 19th century before the Bassett affair. I wondered if anyone would laugh at that, and the answer is no, only a trustee, one. This generation doesn't do history.
Oh, that's it. Attack the kids who are just graduating. Blame the audience. That's a winner for you, Dr. Farmer. It was perhaps the liveliest portion of this excruciating speech. Dr. Farmer gets to the point in his conversation where he was asked to do the commencement speech by the school president.
Now, I said none of this to our dear Dumbledore Gandalf when he and not his wife picked up the phone and asked if I'd give the 2015 commencement speech. Hell yeah, I almost said. Been hoping you've been asked that before Coach K came to dominate. Yo. Done did Yale and Harvard frickin' medical school. 10 years back. Instead, with faux gravitas, to mix unnecessarily highbrow but broadheadian terms, I replied, thank you, Dick. It would be my great honor to do so.
But enough about me. Let me talk about me. Dr. Farmer tries to make another joke that goes flat. God only knows what point he was trying to make here.
Anthro undergrads, PhDs. Duke faculty get over the culture wars yet? The 19th century ones? That was an informed joke and fell flat.
Oh, man.
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
That's the question, isn't it? More God knows what from Dr. Farmer.
Take home messages must number 3, 7, or 9 and be grounded in narrative. I have only 3 And though I don't trust TED Talks any further than I could throw Jahlil Okafor.
What?
I would not have fried and sunburnt you if we were in Wallace Rose Bowl Wade PTSD Stadium.
Wow. It's a tough crowd. Not getting much love from the audience, Dr. Farmer tries to find some common ground by talking some smack and talking some sports.
How about that big win, 68-63? I was in Sierra Leone the day Duke beat Wisconsin. And maybe forgiven for believing that March Madness was a term recently invented to describe the stuttering decline of the Ebola epidemic.
Oh, my goodness. Where's a rim shot when you need one? Oh, there it is.
As poorly timed as his jokes.
Indeed. Farmer goes on to try another joke. Boy, this guy doesn't quit. Give him credit, huh, Jesse? About a bowl that falls so flat, he blames the audience for not getting it.
Kudos to our honorary degree recipient, Dr. Harold Mooney, the plant man, and a Duke grad who shaped the field of modern ecology. Now stop Ebola. Another informed joke wasted on all of you. Ecology, forest.
Oh, he's not done yet. More of this, something about Sports Illustrated, which he calls SI, and Oprah.
SI, Sports Illustrated, reminded me that we all think we live in different worlds. These are, as I learned at Duke, socially constructed. They tend to diverge over time. But in fact, we live in one world, not three. Message one is about the need for what they also used to refer to in the 19th century as fellow feeling. The parable of the Good Samaritan illustrates the point better than I will. But here comes the narrative, one I proffer with full apologies to my teachers and to the administration. You better be laughing. Unfortunately, it's true.
Oh, shut up.
Wade Stadium would be bad enough, what with Oprah and all. Get it? I'd have to follow Oprah.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
Well,
I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.
Well, let's give him one more shot. In closing, Farmer leaves us with this joke about acronyms, because everyone loves a good acronym joke.
Who's about to get a BA today? A BS. A BSE. No, Dean, no, Chancellor Washington, where are you? BSE does not mean bovine spongiform encephalitis.
Oh, that's killer. Hey, look, if you want to see this professor at your local ha-has, start drinking early. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, worst commencement speech of the year, Duke University's Paul Farmer. This is Our American Stories, and we love doing tributes to fathers. We love tributes to hard work. And so often people learn about work from mothers and fathers. This one's a twofer. And it was in our local paper, the Oxford Eagle. And we broadcast from Oxford, Mississippi, just about an hour south of Memphis, and go out to the country. And this piece was titled, A Generation of Hard Workers Leaving. And it was written by Angela Williams, who kindly recorded her story for us. Let's take a listen.
About a month ago, a video surfaced on the internet of the company Carrier announcing that it was going to move the majority of the plant's productions to Mexico.
It became clear that the best way to stay competitive and protect the business for long term
is to move production from our facility in Indianapolis to Monterrey, Mexico.
The person that was making the announcement really couldn't get everyone to quieten down to finish explanations of why it would be better for the company to do this, given the employees would lose their jobs in a year or two.
Listen, I've got information that's important to share as a part of the transition. If we could go ahead, if you don't want to hear it, other people do. So let's quiet down. Thank you very much.
This similar but different situation happened to my dad, James H. Williams, and the employees at Roseburg before the end of 2015. Roseburg Forest Products told the employees the company was shutting down the Oxford branch. By the end of December, nearly all the employees were laid off, except some of the shipping employees, the department where my dad works. They were staying on to ship out what was left of the products and close out the plant. My dad will be 74 this year. He drives a forklift, loading and unloading 18-wheelers of lumber and wood products. It has been there not too long after the plant opened up in 1971, and has worked out there for 45 years. This plant was the very reason why my dad and mom moved from Calhoun County, where jobs were not in abundance, to Oxford, where the plant was brand new and had a lot of jobs, and Oxford offered opportunities for our family. All of my life, I remember my dad coming home with the smell of sawdust and sweat. That was his working cologne. His hat and clothes, lunchbox, and car would be covered in fine sawdust. Anytime I smell sawdust or fresh cut wood, it takes me back to when I was old enough to wrap my little hand around my dad's finger to help me walk across the parking lot. When he wanted to show me the 18-wheelers hauling logs, pulp wood, or lumber. The place was buzzing, no pun intended, of activity of loading trucks. Boxcars to the train, grinding up wood and such. My mom plenty of times had to carry my dad's supper out to him when he had to work a double shift, going in at 6 or 7 a.m. and not coming home until 11 p.m. or later that night or morning. When we drove out there at night to pick him up because his car wasn't working, the night sky would be lit up with lights, where the truckers could see where to pick up and unload, and the huge silos that held the sawdust looked like they could sprout legs and walk. To me, those were the Transformers then. A lot of those silos and even a greenhouse are gone now. No longer needed. Slabs of concrete left bare. The company and the workers became a family. I heard someone say that it was the factory workers, miners, lumberjacks, truckers, train engineers, farmers, ranchers, and so on that make this country as great as it is, and the only ones that keep this country going. Without them, we would be helpless. These men and women might have a college degree or not, but they know hard work, blood, sweat, and tears to bring home barely enough money to pay the bills, buy food, and keep a roof over their families' heads, and to drag their exhausted bodies back to do the same job all over again. People say, well, it is time for him to retire. Yes, that might be true, but I would rather see my dad walk away from that active plant that I grew up knowing than to walk away from a ghost town. I am proud of my dad for sticking with it, when there's been several times to threaten to shut down the plant knowing because of his age that he might not get good work elsewhere. My dad grew up on a farm. He helped his dad in a carpenter shop, and then he enlisted into the Army, where his whole platoon, except him and another person, was shipped off to Vietnam. God had bigger plans for him, though. He moved him here to Oxford to be a father and a grandfather and to be good friends with some of the greatest workers in Mississippi that worked at this plant for 45 years. Dad loaded the last boxcar to leave the plant last week. And this week, my dad will walk that final walk to his car and drive away and say goodbye to a big part of his life.
And that's a great piece by Angela Williams in the Oxford Eagle. And now it's time for Shower Thoughts with Jesse.
Shower Thoughts.
The first guy that died with life insurance never knew if it was a scam. As a teenager, I was told not to trust anyone on the internet and not to be stupid online. Now, I'm telling my parents the same things. USB sounds like a backup plan in case the USA fails. It's pretty dumb that I get a new driver's license every 4 years and it's made out of hard plastic. And I'm supposed to have my social security card for life and it's made out of paper. There's enough apps for finding friends, lovers, and soulmates. I want an app that helps me find my arch enemy. Using your old laptop to research buying a new one is like asking it to dig its own grave. Girl Scouts is basically a brand name cookie company that gets away with child labor. When I unsubscribe from a newsletter and get an email confirming that I've been unsubscribed, it feels like they needed to be the one to say the last word in an argument. Candlelight dinners weren't very special before the light bulb was invented. As an adult, I'm not eating nearly as much ice cream as 10-year-old me thought I would. My dog keeps bringing me the same toy. I wonder if that's his favorite toy or if he thinks it's my favorite toy. Great minds discuss ideas, average minds discuss events, small minds discuss people is a quote that discusses people. In FBI shows, cops are incompetent, unskilled simpletons who just get in the way. In cop shows, the FBI are bureaucratic, incompetent simpletons who just get in the way. The person who would proofread Hitler's speeches was a real-life grammar Nazi. Casinos should let people play Monopoly with real money. Nothing says top of the food chain like squid ink calamari pasta. You're eating another animal and seasoning it with its own defense mechanism. At age 30, you've spent an entire month having birthdays over your lifetime. In a 500-day period, I could theoretically meet someone, get married, have a baby, and get divorced, and yet I'd still be using the same box of Q-tips.
Shower Thoughts.
And thank you for that, Jesse. One day we'll do a whole bunch of them and just celebrate Shower Thoughts. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to catch all the work of the team here that does such great work. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And on this day in history, Henry Kissinger was born in 1923. And as always, this day in history is brought to us by Hillsdale College. And I want to go back to an interview we did with a terrific writer on the subject of Henry Kissinger. And let's take you to that interview right now. Professor of History at Harvard, senior fellow of the Hoover Institution at Stanford, can't make up his mind which coast to live on. He wrote one of the great books, I think, of the last 10 years on World War I, World War II, The War of the World. That was in 2006. And his new book, Kissinger, which is Volume 1, 1923 to 1968, The Idealist. Neil, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Lee.
You bet. You know, you choose Kissinger to write about, and the question has to be, given what Christopher Hitchens has written and given what so many folks have written about this man, Christopher Hitchens, of course, called him a war criminal in his book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger. Why this man and why now, Neil?
Well, it should be said in the spirit of full disclosure that he chose me rather than I chose him. It was Kissinger's idea that I take on a scholarly biography. And at first, I was very hesitant, not least because I imagined a ferocious review by Christopher Hitchens. This was, of course, about 10 years ago when Hitchens was still alive. But after I looked at the documents in Kissinger's private papers, I realized that it was a must to do, because I realized as I read through them just how little we really understood of this man and how far the account in Hitchens' book and in other books was a caricature, a kind of Dr. Evil pantomime villain. The Kissinger that I describe in this first volume, there will be two, is a quite different figure, a refugee, a GI, an anti-Nazi counterintelligence agent in occupied Germany, then an academic who immerses himself in philosophy and history, and latterly a political advisor who worked with not only Nelson Rockefeller, but also with John F. Kennedy, and was about the last person you'd have expected Richard Nixon to name as national security advisor in 1968. So this is a story which is full of surprises, and as an historian, as someone fundamentally committed to historical truth, I really was strongly inclined to write a book that would challenge the established caricature, the established version of Henry Kissinger as Dr. Evil.
Well, from the beginning, Neil, I think what's important is, you know, and you covered this a bit in your really fine Wall Street Journal piece, Kissinger the Freedom Fighter. And by the way, the word idealist is in the title too. And I think you track that idealism, and that's not a word we use or think of when we think of the name Kissinger. You track it back to the idealism of a generation forged, and as you say in the Wall Street Journal, the searing heat of World War II. Take us back there, because that's where the mind of Henry Kissinger and many of ideas, as you say and posit, are formulated.
I think that's right. You have to remember that Kissinger was born and raised in Germany in an Orthodox Jewish community. He was forced to leave Germany by the Nazis, sought refuge and found it in the United States of America 6 years after arriving in the U.S. in 1938. So in 1944, he found himself back in Germany in a U.S. Army uniform on the edge of the Siegfried Line. And the following months saw him in some of the nastiest fighting of the later stages of World War II, the Battle of the Bulge. He saw at first hand what Nazism had done. He was present at the liberation of the concentration camp. He discovered to his horror that at least a dozen of his relatives had died in the Holocaust, including his grandmother. And yet he stayed in Germany longer than he needed to. He didn't return to the U.S. until mid-1947, because as he explained to his parents, he felt that he needed to stay on to try to make sure that the sacrifices of his fallen comrades hadn't been in vain. In other words, that Germany would be reestablished on a sound democratic footing. And that was, I think, one of the motivations for his energetic pursuit of the most hardened Nazis in the period of denazification. So even before he goes to Harvard, even when he's still in an army uniform, The young Kissinger is inspired by a keen sense of the need to fight against totalitarianism and to fight to establish democracy in Germany. He is a committed American. He writes to his parents in 1944, shortly after returning to Germany, how proud he is to be there as an American soldier. And this is a letter he even writes in English. So I'm very struck by the impact that the war and the Holocaust had on him, and the extent to which he saw his purpose in returning to study as being to educate himself about freedom. At Harvard, he is steeped in the philosophy of Immanuel Kant. He writes a senior thesis with the pompous title The Meaning of History, which is, in fact, an extended reflection on the nature of freedom, and says at the end of that, in a very memorable phrase, we should reject totalitarianism, even if it proves to have a more efficient economic system than capitalism. In all these respects, it seems to me, he's best understood as an idealist in his early life.
Well, you know what? We can hear it in his own words. He's interviewed in 1958 by Mike Wallace, and we want to play this clip so the world can hear it. Jesse, roll that clip.
You could well argue that a capitalist society, or what is more interesting to me, a free society, is a more revolutionary phenomenon than 19th century socialism. And this illustrates precisely one of our problems. I think we should go on the spiritual offensive in the world. We should identify ourselves with the revolution. We should say that freedom, if it is liberated, can achieve many of these things. Even when we have engaged in good steps, we've always justified them on the basis of a communist threat, very rarely on the basis of things we wanted to do because of our intrinsic dynamism.
Not exactly a clip you'd expect to hear, but here's Henry Kissinger saying, hey, all this talk of revolution around the world, we Americans need to export our spiritual dimension of our democracy and our republic. Comment on that, Neil.
Yeah, I'm really glad you played that clip. I remember when I heard that for the first time, almost falling off my chair, because it was so unexpected to hear Kissinger very explicitly arguing that the United States needs to be self-confident in promoting its own democratic values, its own commitment to freedom, arguing that the U.S. was too defensive in its attitude towards the war, that it wasn't enough just to be anti-communist. You had to be pro-freedom. This is definitely not the Henry Kissinger that people who've only read Christopher Hitchens expect to encounter. And I think it illustrates perfectly my point that in his early career, particularly as he was coming to prominence as a public intellectual and then as an advisor to Rockefeller and Kennedy, Kissinger was the opposite of the caricature of Kissinger that we've been told about. Two things that are really important to remember here. The one, Kissinger was very reluctant to have anything to do with Nixon and indeed went to considerable lengths to avoid him in the 1960s, publicly criticized him, and was wholly surprised when Nixon turned around in 1968 and offered him the job of National Security Advisor. In fact, the first time Nixon offered him the job, Kissinger was so surprised he didn't realize that that's what Nixon was doing and had to come back and have it re-offered later. So it's a very surprising outcome, this. And the second point to notice is that once he's in the White House in 1969, working under Nixon, at least for the first 2 years, I'd say, and this is a point I'll make in Volume 2, he's very much the junior partner. Nixon had appointed him partly, I think, in the belief that a professor would be rather easy to boss around. And he, Nixon, intended to be making U.S. foreign policy, not the State Department, and the National Security Advisor was supposed to be there to make sure that it was Nixon's policy that got made. So I think we've got to be careful here when we talk about early decisions, 1970, 71, and into 72. We're really talking about Richard Nixon's foreign policy.
The life of Henry Kissinger. More after these messages. He was born on this day in history in 1923. This is Our American Stories, the life of Henry Kissinger celebrated here. And we had just played a clip that I don't think many people would expect to hear from Henry Kissinger. You know, when I stumbled upon that clip myself, I fell out of my chair. Just something I didn't know. Why then does Christopher Hitchens not know that clip exists? Does he not care? He's no longer with us, but what leads to the contempt for Kissinger? Is this the later work of Kissinger with Nixon? Is anyone interested in his biography at all?
I think we're dealing here with a classic historical problem of retrospective distortion. People who were indignant about the Vietnam War, indignant about the coup against Allende in Chile, indignant about the war in Bangladesh, indignant about things that happened in the Nixon presidency, blamed Kissinger for these things, and B, then projected back into his early life character traits that they believed that they'd identified in the 1970s. And so a lot of what was written about Kissinger, even Walter Isaacson's really good early biography, relied heavily on this sort of retrospective distortion. Isaacson, who didn't have access to these sorts of documents, relied quite heavily on interviews, often done in the 1990s, 20 years after the events. And there's a great deal of distortion when people start to look back in anger, as they often did. So I think part of what I'm trying to do is to try to reveal the real young Kissinger without the distortion of what came later. And it is important that this book is a good deal more thoroughly researched than any previous book. I've had access to Kissinger's papers. That's an advantage others didn't have. But I've also used archival materials from at least 49 other archives. And it's been much more thoroughly researched than previous works. Hitchens's book, from memory, only quotes from about, I think it's a dozen or maybe 18 documents. This book cites thousands and thousands of documents. I think Hitchens would be the first to admit that his is more a work of journalism, a polemical work, than a work of serious scholarship. And ultimately, I put scholarship ahead of polemics.
Well, and I think we know, because we have one little clip of Christopher. He's at a book signing in 2001, Neil, and I wanted to play this clip of him. And it's not just that he's reporting. Listen to the sneering. Listen to the contempt. And Christopher was a friend. But this is almost inexcusable.
I met Murder on the way. He had a face like Castlereagh. Now, a great deal of what Henry Kissinger has done to this republic and to its democracy and its constitution and to countless defenseless populations and individuals around the world, a great deal of what he's done has actually been justified in point of saving face. I'm sure you know how the argument goes. If we don't kill all these people, everyone will think we've gone soft.
And there you have it. Mass murder, in the end, a serial killer is almost what he's calling Henry Kissinger, guilty of war crimes.
You see, the problem for Hitch, whom I knew and whom I was rather fond of, was that he couldn't quite resist over-egging, exaggerating and caricaturing, because it made for good journalism. I mean, this whole enterprise that produced the trial of Henry Kissinger began as journalism, and I think it ended as journalism. If you attempt to look carefully at the historical record, you get a very, very different picture. Now, I'm not prejudging Volume 2, which is going to cover the years 1969 to the present, and I'm not going to tell you ahead of time, when I'm still doing the research, my final verdict on the kinds of issues that Hitchens discusses in his book. But what I can say is that this notion that you're dealing with some sort of bloodthirsty fiend who enjoyed death and devastation can't really stand up to close scrutiny. This is cartoon history, not serious history. What you have to ask yourself if you're writing about the Cold War is, what exactly were the stakes? What was at stake? What was the strategy that Nixon
favored. The challenges facing the United States in 1969 when they came into office were absolutely horrendous. They were largely inherited from the previous administration. The war in Vietnam had gone horribly wrong. The Soviet Union was making gains in all kinds of respects. The U.S. economy was in terrible shape and fast getting worse. And the United States had to figure out a new strategy because Johnson's had so failed. And I think Nixon, with Kissinger's assistance, devises an ambitious strategy, the main objective of which is to avoid World War III, hence the desire for disarmament talks, or at least arms limitation talks with the Soviets. There's a desire to exploit the Sino-Soviet split to get some kind of opening to China to happen, which turns out to be the key strategic move of the entire Cold War. And then there's a whole bunch of secondary problems, getting out of Vietnam, but also trying to establish some kind of peace in the Middle East. Those are the things that are on the top of the agenda for the Nixon administration. In order to achieve these objectives, there are a great deal of other lesser problems that it's extremely hard to solve easily, and there are sacrifices that have to be made. One of Kissinger's points as a young scholar was, most foreign policy decisions are choices between evils. You don't get many options that make you feel good the way motherhood and apple pie does, and therefore it's a moral act, it can be a moral act, to choose an evil option if it's the lesser of two evils, and if it ultimately serves some strategic goal. So the correct way to judge foreign policy decisions is by the strategic standard. Is there some sense in which an action serves a strategic purpose, and in doing so, averts a worse outcome?
Yeah, and that
most
would be...
people who write uncritically about Kissinger fail to apply that kind of standard, and instead engage in a kind of emotive hand-wringing about specific cases that, without seeing their position in the broader strategy.
You know, I'm going to close with this because I think it's so important. And you write, and again, we're back in that Wall Street Journal article, and we're talking to Neil Ferguson, professor of history at Harvard, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and author of Kissinger, Part 1. This is Volume 1 of 2, 1923 to 1968, The Idealist. Kissinger, you said, rejected the economic determinism of Marxism-Leninism, which saw all human affairs as rigidly driven by class struggle. But you say here, Neil, he was also critical of those who thought that the West's superiority was just a matter of higher productivity. Talk about that.
There were plenty of people in Kissinger's generation who thought it was all about economics. In fact, you can really trace the rise of economics as a discipline in American universities to the early Cold War period. And he was regarded as a bit of a crank for wanting to work on 19th century diplomatic history when he could have been doing systems analysis, game theory, or something like the theory of economic growth that his rough contemporary Walt Rostow worked on. I think the critical point here is that Kissinger saw the Cold War had to be about more than just a race to see which economic system generated the most rapid growth. There was no guarantee at this stage that it would be the American system, and a great many people worried through the 1950s that actually Khrushchev was right, and that the Soviets might overtake the United States. Of course, this turned out to be nonsense, but we have to remember how many people feared it might be true. But I think Kissinger makes a second and much more important point, and that is that the Cold War has to be fundamentally about the idea of freedom. As he says, you've got to reject totalitarianism, even if it turns out to be a better economic system, because it completely crushes individual liberty. And for Kissinger, that's the highest goal. You can't let the Soviets win in the Third World. You can't let them win a Cold War showdown with the United States, because if they win, then freedom loses. And I think that's the sense in which he can be understood as an idealist. Of course, once you find yourself in the decision making situation, once you're in the White House with Richard Nixon contending with a bombardment of crises, it's pretty hard to stick to that principle in every case. And this is why we see the compromises that get made with authoritarian regimes, the blind eyes that get turned when those regimes engage in violence against their own people or other peoples. But Kissinger always knew that that would be his fate. He always said there's something fundamentally tragic about being a statesman, because the stuff that you have to do to to avoid worse outcomes, you won't get any thanks for. Ultimately, you have to consider the fact that Cold War statesmen avoided a hot war. They avoided World War III. Détente, which had many critics on the right, indeed more critics on the right than on the left, might well have been preferable to a more hostile strategy of confrontation with the Soviets in the 1970s, which could, after all, have gone horribly wrong. So my sense here is that we've got to understand Kissinger's most important idea, the problem of conjecture. Kissinger says you have to do all sorts of things, not nice at all in many cases, to avoid a really disastrous outcome. And as you do those things, you need to be aware that you will not be thanked, because in avoiding catastrophe, you won't get gratitude. People aren't grateful for disasters that don't happen.
That's right.
But always in his mind was the memory of the 1930s. He says the appeasers were hard-headed or thought of themselves as tough realists, but their realism in appeasing the dictators had led ultimately to World War II. I think one has to understand that the overarching goal of Kissinger's life was to avoid World War III. He had seen World War II up close and very personal indeed. And this, I think, was what shaped his early life and future life.
Well, we begin where we end. Neil, a terrific book. Thanks so much for joining us. Neil Ferguson, Kissinger, 1923 to 1968, The Idealist. Thanks, Neil.
Thank you very much, Dean.
Riders on the storm.
And that's Neil Ferguson, Henry Kissinger, born on this day in history, May 27, 1923.